Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHN.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome back our great guest co-host, Dr. Catherine Koh. Welcome back, Catherine.
Thanks so much. It's great to be back.
Well, you know, we're going to have some interesting conversations today, and we'll be talking with Dr. Alondra Nelson, professor of sociology and dean of social science at Columbia University, about her new book, The Social Life of DNA and How Science and Medicine Influence Conversations About Race. I'm looking forward to that.
It sounds like a really interesting topic.
Yeah, I think we'll both learn something as well as our listeners. Let's dive right into our research that matters. And our very first one is about something that I think both of us probably see a lot and we need help with, which is, what do we do when we have a teenager or a younger child who comes into our offices that's really quite depressed?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So this was a new study that came out in The Lancet looking at the 14 different medicines that are commonly prescribed to children for depression. And really what they found was that the only one that they would recommend, if you were to even use that term, would be Prozac, and that the rest showed little to no benefit. And even Prozac was kind of risky, them saying that, you know, they'd prefer more behavioral modifications as a means for treating the depression in these children.
Yeah, that Prozac or fluoxetine, because every medicine's got a generic name and a brand name. Mm-hmm. You're right. They found what they call a meta-analysis, putting together all those studies of about 5,200 children and teens at 34 previous studies, and that the Prozac was the only one that had some effect, and it, I guess, had a range of effect from not very much to very significant. And the authors went on to say, well, then, you know, they don't recommend any of these other medicines, but don't stop your medicine if you're taking one of those other medicines in your child. What are you thinking about this?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's important that if someone is on a medicine, like you said, to not stop it. But the authors also come up with an interesting solution, saying that other things that have been shown to be effective against depression, such as regular exercise, adequate sleep, can really make a difference. And so really trying to increase those in order to augment therapy.
You know, one of the things that I think we sometimes discount is clinical experience. And unfortunately, in this particular field, I found that only 34 studies with only 5,000 kids was actually woefully inadequate. Mm-hmm. That's not enough to actually show effects for many of these medications. And I think the fact that depression and suicide among young kids has increased actually significantly, and a lot of them may have gone through a lot of these available therapies. So I worry a little bit about how this is going to be perceived, and I know they say don't stop it, talk with your doctor, but I think there will be a push to stop medicines, and I do think we need to be really, really careful here. Obviously, more to come, and probably one thing we can all agree on is there really needs to be a lot more research here about dealing with severe depression in young children, because that is a very tragic problem.
Absolutely. I'm really interested about this next research study that talks about a bioprosthetic ovary for a mouse, and then this mouse was able to go on and successfully have a litter of pups. I guess that's the technical term for baby mice.
Bioprosthetic ovary? You know, what are we talking about here? And I think what I realize they're talking about is this 3D reconfiguration in essentially a test tube of something that looks, acts, feels, and maybe does what a tissue could do, in this case, an ovary.
Yeah, so it's very interesting. A researcher, Teresa Woodruff, out of Northwestern University, did this study where they found this gelatinous material that they could print an ovary out of and then implant it with follicles that went on to stimulate normal hormone production in this mouse.
Yeah, they take different materials on a platform, and apparently this platform, this gelatin, is really critical because it allows everything to kind of stay together long enough to the place where they have this ovary that they could be functioning like an ovary, essentially in that test tube, and they can then transplant that ovary into the mouse. And in this case, like you said, It had healthy pups.
And was even able to nurse them, too. So showing that I guess, reached normal hormone levels.
You know, I found this really, I said, wow, this is pretty amazing. And, of course, they jump right to the Holy Grail, which is, can you use this as a platform for women who are infertile, not able to have children, to then allow them to have children with the transplantation generation of an ovary? I think there's a lot more between what they did and this. I thought, okay, what are all the steps here? What is the safety? What is the effectiveness in humans? Lots of issues that I would want to know about.
Yeah, but certainly a step in the right direction.
Step in the right direction, certainly for these mouse pups. Let's talk about our next research that matters. Men who may have or are at risk of developing prostate cancer. We know there's not a whole lot right now, and what's there is a little bit controversial.
The press has had a lot of information about this prostate-specific antigen, which helps to detect whether or not a man is at risk or has prostate cancer, as I think has come to a conclusion, it warrants a discussion with your doctor rather than one fit for all people.
We've always been interested in, is there a better test? Because the digital rectal exam doesn't really do much for detecting prostate cancer early. It's not a recommended screening test. So we're looking for these screening tests. And this is a new one that they had in this study that was published in the journal European Urology about what's known as ISO-PSA, a team of researchers from the Cleveland Clinic and other places in the United States.
Yeah, so this ISO-PSA, how they studied it is they tested that against the one that is well known right now, the PSA, in 261 men who were already scheduled for a prostate biopsy. So they were already concerned or thinking about tissue in order to further diagnose it. And what they found is that this new test, the ISO-PSA, detects prostate cancer more precisely than the current two tests, able to better distinguish between benign conditions, such as benign prostatic hypertrophy, and also identifying high-risk disease.
And they said that the patients who got the ISO-PSA could reduce unnecessary biopsies by almost 50%. There is a test that's existing already called a free PSA that you can get in if you have a kind of a borderline elevated PSA. It helps differentiate perhaps if you need a biopsy or not. And I think this is the next generation of tests that are coming down the road, which may be better than their first test and maybe not need two blood tests, but a single blood test. Too soon, but I'm really hopeful.
Yeah, definitely more studies need to come, but it does seem promising.
Let's talk about very last research that matters. And that's about something that you probably have had more experience than I have in the last 3 years, which is taking care of hospitalized patients and needing to get blood cultures. That happens pretty regularly, doesn't it?
Yeah, very regularly. So anytime we're concerned that someone might be sick or that they might have an infection that's in their bloodstream, we get blood cultures where they take a small amount of blood and put it into a culture medium, and we see what grows at 24, 48 hours and onwards.
And a problem is that a lot of times, you know, you're busy, people are busy, the blood draw, people are busy, and sometimes those things get contaminated, or you get some bacteria that first growing in there, and you're thinking, is it contaminant or is it real, and you don't know what to do? Maybe it's a false positive, but you maybe have to give antibiotics. That's expensive.
It's very expensive, and it can also be risky for patients. So if a patient has a false positive blood culture, we usually give them antibiotics because they can get sick really quickly, so we try and prevent that. But they may not have actually needed antibiotics in the first place.
Yeah, in this particular study, they actually have a new way of doing it, which is that first little bit of blood that you take out kind of goes into a little storing place, and then they put the next set of blood into where the cultures. And they found out that they could reduce the false positives. They went from 1.78% down to 0.2%, an 88% reduction. This was published in Clinical Infectious Diseases. I think this becomes a standard of care. Now, part of the question is how expensive is this technology? But I bet given the cost of a false positive and everything else, I think I would want my hospital doing this particular test. I hope it moves pretty quickly into production.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Londra Nelson, professor of sociology and dean of social science at Columbia University, about the social life of DNA, her new book about how science and medicine influence conversations about race. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Koh. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Koh. Today on Conversations, Catherine, we'll be talking with Dr. Alondra Nelson, Professor of Sociology and Dean of Social Science at Columbia University, about her new book, The Social Life of DNA, and how science and medicine influence conversations about race.
Welcome, Dr. Nelson. We're so excited to have you on the show today.
I'm glad to be with you, Catherine and Adam. Thank you.
How did you get interested in both sociology and studying things like ancestry?
Sure. So I grew up in San Diego, California, and those of you who know San Diego know it's a big science city. It's a big biotech city. So I grew up really suffused in science and technology all around me. And as a young person in middle school, you know, I was tracked very early on a science track. So I was supposed to be some kind of scientist. And then I got to the University of California at San Diego and became very interested in the classics. So I was interested in archaeology and became very interested in ethnography and the ways that we come to think about science and technology. And some of this was because I was able to take up, for example, a physics class with the late astronaut Sally Ride, who's now deceased. But she taught us about how to calculate vectors for the space shuttle. So it was really the first time that science had, to me, had a kind of social element. We were doing something. It wasn't like in my high school physics class where I was calculating how long it'll take to pull up this many bricks in a wagon. You were actually doing something in the world, and you could imagine that people's lives were at stake. So I came to think about science as being part of a larger social ecology, and that's really where it started.
You were a science nerd that became un-nerd-like in your passion for studying those who were interested in science.
Exactly. I think most people would say I'm still fairly nerdy, but I became interested in all the sort of web that science sits in, all the things around it. So by the time I got to graduate school to do my PhD at NYU, I also became very interested in a growing conversation that's now reached a crescendo about women and folks of color in the STEM fields and the lack thereof. And really thinking, you know, if one comes from a community like my community, which is African American, how do you imagine being a STEM field professional, going to medical school, going to nursing school, given what I now knew as this sort of deep and sometimes very dark history of medical experimentation and exploitation of, you know, marginalized and often vulnerable communities. So I became interested in these kind of stories and moments and instances in which particularly African American communities were trying to work their way through this history and come out on the other side as health activists, as top-ranked doctors, as people who were interested in taking up science and medicine as a powerful tool in their lives and not only a tool of peril or something that would bring harm or damage.
So it sounds like your upbringing and experiences really helped contextualize the sciences for you. And it sounds as though you're trying to see how your past and how others' past might impact their future. How particularly did ancestry or looking at DNA come into it?
So in 2002 and 2003, I became very interested in these new accounts that suggested that we were going to have a new commercial market of direct-to-consumer genetics. And I thought, you know, A, is this going to take off? B, if it does take off, who will be the early adopters? Who would be interested in this? For whom is this a market that they really want to be engaged and involved with? And because, as I said, I'm interested in African Americans' engagements with science and technology, I got particularly interested in the promise that this new direct-to-consumer genetics industry might be able to solve this roots puzzle for African Americans. So in the late 1970s and 1976, Alex Haley publishes his book, Roots, The Saga of an American Family. The next year in 77, it becomes a television miniseries that ran for 8 days. It ran when I was a child, and that left a big impact on me. So I thought, you know, will African Americans be, you know, a particularly robust market for this? And so I came to sort of follow that story. But some of the story is also about the growing strength and power of ancient DNA analysis. And so, you know, some of these techniques were being used to give us some inferences about ancestry and identity of people who had lived in the distant past, in addition to some inferences about family history and potentially closer ancestry. So that, in some ways, was kind of, you know, my early interest as an undergraduate in archaeology sort of coming to bear on this as well.
Why is the social life of DNA particularly important for the African-American community, but perhaps for even broader, any community?
Oh, I think it's key for all of us. You know, what happens with the Post-Human Genome Project, which is this big commercial and private research project that decodes a sort of, you know, aggregate of, you know, a select few people that is supposed to stand in for the whole human genome, a project that begins in 1991, and the first draft of it is complete in 2002. So this project takes a great deal of computing power, a great deal of collaborative research, and yields different new insights about genetics. So we often think of genetics as being about medicine or only about the criminal justice system, if you think about forensic uses of DNA, or only about ancestry. But what you have in a kind of post-genome world is genetic data that can be used in all of these realms simultaneously. So even if the intention, for example, with a 23andMe test is to get health information, of course, 23andMe is doing also analyses that provide information about ancestry. And so the social life of DNA is really to suggest that genetic data, you know, in a world that's post-genomic and also in a world of big data analysis, can be used in lots of different places, regardless of the intent of where the data comes from. And so we have increasingly in this new social world of DNA, this new social life of DNA, DNA being used to answer questions in lots of different spheres of life, not just clinical medicine, clinical research, or increasingly the new precision medicine that we're talking about. It's really circulating more widely in our social world.
And you talk about how the science of DNA can impact these conversations, particularly when it comes to race and reparations. Do you mind telling us more about that and how it's been used so far?
Sure. So as I suggested earlier, one of the curiosities is if you're familiar with the sort of history of medical experimentation on African Americans, that sort of the archetype of this is often the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, in which African American men were left untreated with syphilis to see how it would evolve in its tertiary stages, and, you know, now is widely accepted as an inhumane research project. And we know in the medical sociology literature, there's lots of literature on experiences of distrust or mistrust with medicine. You know, I became interested in, as I suggested earlier, whether or not African Americans would be eager users of genetic ancestry testing and what they would do with it. So I thought that it was the sort of key here, what the keen interest would be answering this roots question. So we have this Alex Haley moment, the apex of which is in the late 1970s, and he creates an expectation, not only for African Americans. I mean, this roots phenomenon becomes a big fad in the late 1970s across the United States. So the expectation is created that if you're an African American, that you can trace your roots back to the continent of Africa. So that expectation is created for a generation or two, but we actually don't have the tools to do it. And we now know in retrospect that some of what Haley said he accomplished with his genealogy family history research was actually some of that was fictionalized. So we have this expectation, and then when we have this in the early aughts, this direct-to-consumer market, you have a tool to do something about that with. So I thought that this tool, and I went and did lots of interviews with people. I ended up doing ethnographic research for about 10 years, and that meant that I joined local genealogical societies, national genealogical bodies. I went to lots lots of genetics conferences. I went to commercial direct-to-consumer genetics conferences and gatherings and convenings. And I thought that I was going to be telling a story about the transformation of identity after genetic ancestry testing. So I thought I was this, and now I think I'm this.
We're going to need to actually take a short break. We're talking with Dr. Alondra Nelson, Professor of Sociology and Dean of Social Sciences at Columbia University, about her new book, The Social Life of DNA. We're going to take a short break, but we'll be right back with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Crowe with Your Health. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Coe. We've been talking with Dr. Alondra Nelson, Professor of Sociology and Dean of Social Science at Columbia University, about her new book, The Social Life of DNA. And right before the break, Dr. Nelson, you were really kind of leading us to understanding how and why people maybe take this DNA and look at it in ways that influence not only race, but reparations and life stories. You yourself got tested.
Yes. So I spent, at this point when I got tested, I'd spent about 8 years talking to people and realizing that I thought I was telling a story about personal identity and realizing that people were trying to tell bigger stories about the historical memory of slavery, about what it means to have lost identity and try to find it, not unlike adoption stories. And this was a project in which I was giving lots of presentations as I was writing the book. And inevitably, at these presentations, someone would ask a question and say, well, have you taken the test? And at first, I took this as, you know, people were just being curious. And then it became clear to me that it was a question of credibility. So, you know, how can I trust you as a researcher if you haven't had the experience? And I thought to myself, you know, right, that's a legitimate question. And also, you know, if I want to understand for myself the depths of what people are experiencing that have a kind of deeper social and political meaning, you know, I should do this test. And so I find myself on a stage in September in the fall of 2010 or 2011 in Atlanta. And there's lots of African expatriates were there. This was the week after the UN General Assembly, so there were lots of African politicians in the country, many African Americans, including some prominent folks like former Ambassador Andrew Young, who was a peer of Martin Luther King Jr. And I find myself on a stage. I take a mitochondrial DNA test, which traces the mother's line, and I'm told that I am inferred to be connected in some way to the Bamileke people of Cameroon. And, you know, a couple of things happened after I received the test. I told my parents, and they had completely opposite reactions. So my father kind of looked up, you know, my father reads, is a bit of an autodidact, reads about 5 newspapers a day. So he's always reading one of them, drinking coffee. So he sort of looked up from one of his many newspapers and sort of said, oh, you know, that's interesting. My mother, to the far extreme, said, we're from Cameroon. And it could have been because it was mitochondrial DNA. I explained to them that it was through the mother's line. And, you know, my mother got very excited about it. She realized that the Catholic church that she went to, there was another family of African descent there, a woman named Anne, and who was married to a gentleman named Jacob, and they have a little boy, Joshua, who were immigrants to the United States from Cameroon, one of whom in the marriage were Bamileke. So my mother had been acquaintances of them, but they became fast friends. And last Thanksgiving, they were at our family Thanksgiving table. My mom made a roast turkey, and our Bamileke cousin, quote-unquote cousin, brought roast goat with plantain as part of the Thanksgiving meal.
Wow. So you not only decide to take the step to get tested, but sounds like you did it in a pretty public way, but it sounds like the reaction was priceless. It also sounds like perhaps taking this DNA and ancestry and looking backwards is not only to help kind of look back at stories, but it sounds like creating new stories and new ways for people to interact and come together in fellowship.
Yes, that's right. That's the thing I found tremendous about this. I mean, whatever one might say about what's different from medical genetics is that you've got the gold standard of science there. You know, you will verify, reproduce, and these sorts of replicate. There's a different kind of threshold for evidence in medical genetics than there is in the direct-to-consumer space. But what's definitely true about the direct-to-consumer space is that it's very powerful in creating relationships between people. So for my mother and for a gentleman that I write about named Marvin in my book, I mean, there were people they had sort of known, but the test results become an occasion to have like really genuine relationships with people. I referred to this family as my Cameroonian cousins. We see very soon after the introduction of direct-to-consumer genetics that there are new kinship categories, new categories of family emerging. So people use the words like DNA cousin as a way to talk about these kind of new forms of family that are emerging.
You know, I found out recently through a kind of family genomics on my wife's side of the family that they were related to one of the most famous rabbis, the Vilna Gaon of Lithuania. It just made me want to learn more and reconnect with something and maybe a tradition that would inform. How do you recommend exploring genetics?
You know, we've really in the last couple of years have entered a kind of new, I think, exciting stage for doing genealogy and family history. You know, you've got the ability for you to, as a consumer, to get your data from a company, any company you might choose, and there's several to choose from. And you can use third-party applications, like there's one called GEDmatch, G-E-D-Match, that you can upload your data, play around with it, compare your data to other people. So there's a kind of citizen science aspect to genealogy now, if you want to have that experience. And then a company like Ancestry.com now makes it very easy to layer conventional genealogy. So Ancestry has, as you know, vital records and all sorts of conventional genealogy records, draft cards, census records, and these sorts of things. And it's getting increasingly easier to layer these with genetic data. And you can see if there are, you know, clues that might suggest that from the conventional genealogy that might suggest things about the genetic genealogy and vice versa. And the Ancestry sort of software suite also connects you with other people who have both done conventional and genetic genealogy. So there's a kind of depth to the work now, and there's an ability, I think, for people to really engage themselves in thinking about the research and making their own assessment about the claims that the companies are making as they learn more about the technology. So I think that's been one of the more interesting turns in recent years.
Certainly helpful tips for our listeners who are with us today. Dr. Nelson, as part of the title of your book, you know, we already touched on how the social life of DNA can impact race and reparations, but the third thing that you list is reconciliation in this post-genomic world. And walk us through kind of your thoughts in that and how that is impacted.
Yes. So I thought I was interested in writing about identity and people and their identity, and I found out I was, but in a different way. And one of the times when I was interviewing people that this happened is one of my encounters with the family of a formerly enslaved man named Venture Smith, who was buried in East Haddam, Connecticut, north of New Haven. And every fall at a congregational church, his family holds what's called Venture Smith Day. So they gather there, they pay tribute to him. He became a very successful businessman. He bought himself out of slavery and then bought members of his family out of slavery. And before he died, was actually very successful. He was also very important because he wrote a slave narrative and was able to narrate his story from the continent of Africa to the Americas. Then his family, in about 2006, gives permission to researchers to exhume his body, to do genetic analysis on it, and tell us where in Africa he comes from. So to me, this was a curious endeavor because he had left, as I suggested, the slave narrative, pretty much in his own words, that tells us about where he came from. So we know the name of his village or the name of his family members. He tells us about his voyage to the Americas. And so I thought, well, what is the DNA going to tell us? And so I asked some eighth generation descendants this question. And one of them said, well, you know, we think it'll be educational. And another said, I think it can bring healing. And so I came to think about genetic ancestry testing as a tool of healing and as a tool of reconciliation, of drawing together parties that had been disunited, I guess, to use a clumsy word. And I came to think of reconciliation projects not only about the descendants of slaves in the United States, but also the uses of genetics in other societies to bring a kind of sense of social repair. So another example of this is this is the early days of contemporary genetics in the mid-1980s in Argentina, after there was a political, sort of authoritarian political regime is put down, but not before the regime has disappeared a lot of activists who were protesting against it. And they've taken the children of these activists and placed them in families of people who were allied with this government. And a social movement, a human rights group called the Grandmothers of the May Plaza, emerges in Buenos Aires, Argentina. And they work with a very prominent, now prominent geneticist named Mary Claire King, who's at the University of Washington, to use genetics to reunite their families, to reunite these grandmothers with their grandchildren who had been placed in other families. So I came to think about DNA and late 20th, early 21st century genetic analysis playing a role in being able to do a kind of humanitarian identification and reunion and reconciliation. And that's how I get to the last piece of the story.
Well, we're so glad that you took us on part of that journey. I think for those of us who have lost family members, whether it's in Holocaust or genocide or trauma, worldwide slavery, experimentation in medicine, this is a potential for healing, and that is tremendous. And we have to thank you for taking us there.
Thank you so much, Adam and Catherine.
We've been talking with Dr. Alondra Nelson, Professor of Sociology and Dean of Social Science at Columbia University, about her new book, The Social Life of DNA, and we'll put it up on our website. We want to thank you for stimulating our conversation about science and medicine, maybe making us a little bit of science geeks in the right way to really consider conversations about race. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for being with us.
A true pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Catherine Koh. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. On 97.9 FM, WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Catherine and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
And if you have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, then please send your comments to yourhealth, that's one word, at unc.edu.
I'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question about a college graduate.
I just graduated from college and I'm about to start a new job. I was also just diagnosed with lupus. Do you have any advice for how I should think about managing this new diagnosis, especially as I start working?
Congratulations on that college graduation. Mm-hmm. I have a son who graduated from college recently.
Big milestone.
Big milestone. On the other hand, I'm really sorry to hear about the new diagnosis of lupus. That's difficult. It's a chronic illness, and we know that not everyone can always stay healthy.
Yeah, and it's also one that you may or may not be prescribed a new medication. And I think part of the challenge as you go into this next step and phase in your life is trying to figure out a schedule or a routine to ensure that you are taking the medications as you're supposed to.
Yeah, I would also want you to make sure that you are in a situation where you get plenty of sleep and regular sleep. So, you know, if it was a job that required you to be working night shift, that could be really difficult for sleep cycles. And for you in particular, that's probably a major issue. I would also think stress in a new job is always perhaps there, but maybe some jobs are more stressful than others. And I would think early on, I may not be in a job that would be as stressful. And I'd also wonder about, is your boss or bosses, do they have a real good understanding of what lupus is, and are they willing to give you some flexibility? You might need days off more than others, at least until the disease is under good control.
Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is, depending on what kind of medicine you've been prescribed, you may be more prone to getting some coughs and colds that are around your new office. So making sure that you have good hand hygiene, keep a bottle of hand sanitizer, something around to decrease your risk of getting sick.
Yeah, and even make sure you're up to date on all your immunizations, because there may be some new ones that you haven't gotten that you may need to avoid the illness. And then, you know, finally, I would say there's support groups. You know, there are support groups in the community and lupus support groups. We had a guest on our show, Catherine and I, a couple of years ago, who had just written a book about lupus and support and self-help. There's a lot of things that a lot of people in the workplace don't know. You may not know. You can help educate them and be an advocate and get support for this. Well, good luck. We wish you the best and congratulations again on finishing college. Laura, what's our very next house call?
Our doctor just told us that our 14-year-old daughter is anemic. What does that really mean, and what should we be doing about it?
I don't think this was a personality assessment. What do
you... Oh, yeah, definitely not.
Yeah,
no.
You're kind of anemic, you know.
No, I don't think
that's what the doctor was talking about. But I can't believe a doctor would just come in and use that term without a lot more description.
Yeah, so when they said anemic, that typically means that she had lower counts of red blood cells, which carry oxygen to our whole body. Can occur from a variety of reasons, most commonly in someone who's, say, 14-year-old, if she's getting regular periods, would be from what's called an iron deficiency anemia, meaning not quite enough iron in the diet in order to keep up with the necessary red blood cell production.
Yeah, there could be a lot of reasons. Sometimes something that appears anemia, there are certain hereditary conditions in African Americans, people from Mediterranean descent, where you may look like the blood counts are actually low, but may not really be a true anemia as we think about it. Because when we say anemia means, you know, the Greek without hema, blood, without blood. And so this lower blood count, but it doesn't have to always be abnormal, though most times most people can take some iron because they're not getting enough iron in their diet or having enough iron, perhaps cooking with cookware, iron skillets that have iron. You can do it through lots of ways.
Mm-hmm. I think it would be important to address some follow-up questions with your doctors, see if they have any treatment recommendations.
Yeah, there's a really simple blood test that can be done to track the iron stores. It's called ferritin. I never can spell it easily, but I think it's F-E-R-R-I-T-I-N. Mm-hmm. That's how I always remember. I spell it wrong with the T-E-M, but it's like ferritin. And maybe we can have our health sciences librarians put up a little link there about sources of dietary iron, the foods that are high in iron, because most people could use more iron. It seems to have lots of benefits, not only for blood counts, but for the way we think. It helps improve our thinking. What's our very last house call, Laura?
I've noticed that my vision gets a little fuzzy after I stare at the computer for too long, and it often coincides with headaches. Do you have any suggestions for that?
Well, what's the first thing it makes you think of, Catherine? Because I think of, oh, Lord, I mean, a lot of us get kind of headaches when we're just at the computer for long periods of time. Not necessarily from just looking at it, but then it's just that neck. You're straining your muscles. You're bending over. It's really uncomfortable.
Yeah, I guess it also depends on what kind of work you're doing at your computer. Is it stressful work or is it catching up on the latest Netflix TV show?
Ooh, that'd be lovely.
It would be nice.
Yeah, I think it's for most of us, it's this kind of looking at a screen. And but certainly getting an eye exam would be a good idea, because if you haven't had one in a long time, there may be a problem with your vision.
Yeah, definitely. Also, potentially taking more frequent breaks from the computer screen, allowing your eyes to adjust back and forth a little bit more. But you found some extra tips for us.
Yeah, and we'll, again, maybe have our great health sciences librarians put up some tips. This was one from All About Vision, a nice website. But it says, like, you know, proper lighting. If there's too much light coming from outside or too much ambient light in the room, this can cause eye strain, glare. We all know that that's a really big important. And you can put anti-glare screens on your monitors, which can be really helpful. The display and the settings of the display.
Might be time for an upgrade.
Might be time for an upgrade. I think our listeners would like to hear that. And then finally, you can actually get these anti-glare, or computer screen goggles and special glasses that maybe, if particularly if you wear contact lenses, that kind of adjust the level of acuity you need to actually read the words on the screen, which are different maybe long distance and short-term vision. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, that's an awesome device.
Yeah, the one I wasn't just so crazy about was blinking more often. Okay, that... That's good, but I think I like your idea. Just get up and take some shorter and longer breaks.
Yeah, and I think definitely checking in with an eye doctor if you haven't in a while.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls today and your health as well. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to you and your health. You can send your own questions to yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or search our app, Your Health, one word, for a free download. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine and UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. Our great guest co-host today, Dr. Catherine Koh, and Dr. Alondra Nelson, our guest today. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Catherine Koh.
And we look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.